And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
As I have said in the past, there are a handful of strategies or tables of information that I think have been the most impactful work that we've done in terms of getting investors to take a stand and hopefully keep a stand as a long-term investment strategy. And the most impactful would be the ultimate buy and hold strategy. And along with that, I think the fine-tuning tables that help people determine the right amount of fixed income and the right amount of equity, I think those tables have been educational and helpful in people making important decisions. And certainly the distribution tables that show the long-term impact of taking a 3% or 4% or 5% either fixed or variable distribution. Great resources for investors who are faced with some of the most important decisions of their life. And typically, we're talking about people who are in retirement or close to retirement, and I think most of our work is impacting people from age 40 on, although we are also working hard to try to help the first-time investor do better. But there is one strategy above all the rest that I think will probably create the biggest payday. And that is the strategy designed for a newborn child or a very young investor. Doesn't have to be newborn, but somebody who has a lot of years until retirement. And so we designed this strategy that we discuss under the title of How to Turn $3,000 into $50 million. Now, you can accomplish the same thing if instead of investing $3,000 once, let's say at the birth of a child, that you would invest $365 a year over a period of 21 years. So instead of investing $3,000 once, you invest $365 21 times, or instead of a $3,000 investment, it will be about $7,665. So you can pay now or you can pay over time, but it turns out that the end result is almost the same. Now, I do not want to suggest for one second that $3,000 is the only way this works, because if you only want to put away $1,000 once, or you want to put away $100 a year over 21 years, the outcome will be the same in terms of the compound rate of return and whatever you have at the end of this 95-year period, but you just won't have as much. But 12% is 12%, whether it's on $3,000 or $1,000 or $365 a year or $100 a year. They'll all be impactful because you have a good investment up front, and you have time, so much time to have this money work. And in order to get to this $50 million, it doesn't mean you have to invest and just have it sit there and then wait until you die and you leave $50 million to your heirs. No, the idea is you put away this money early. Again, let's just talk about the $3,000. You put that money away early. It grows. And by the way, it could grow in your name until the child is old enough to make money and qualify for IRA contributions, especially Roth IRA contributions, because here is theoretically an opportunity to not only have money put aside for these young people, but to have it compound tax-free and then take distributions that are tax-free. I mean, it could be a monster investment for the long term. Now then you have it grow in an IRA as soon as you can. So it grows in an account, let's say in your name, but you've got it earmarked for that child, okay? And it grows, and let's say in a small cap value fund, it grows until the child is 16 or 17 or 18 and they start earning some money, and then you start dipping into whatever money is there, take out enough to match whatever they make up to the maximum Roth IRA contribution, and you do that until that money is gone, and then in theory, you then let it grow under their name in their Roth IRA until they're 65. That's what we used in the study, and then at age 65, you start taking out 4% a year, and then it continues to grow, and you take less risk when you're in retirement than getting up to what you have at age 65. But the bottom line is you take out 4% a year, and you let the rest of it grow, and you could, in theory, take out $20 million and leave $30 million to heirs. Now, of course, this all assumes that everybody keeps their hands off the money. Okay, you set the account up. You earmarked it in on your ledger. This investment is for Johnny. It's not for me or my wife. It's for somebody specifically. And so does that mean that you couldn't, if you wanted to, take that money and go spend it if you felt like it? Of course, it's still in your name. But once you've transitioned it over to Johnny, it's now Johnny's to do what he wants to do with it. So, yes, we've gotten past you being tempted by that money. Now we have 60 years, or let's call it 40 to 50 years, that you got to keep it out of, keep Johnny on track and him committed to making this become this huge payoff. It's not a pipe dream. It really isn't. And if we could just, maybe the pipe dream is that the future will look like the past. The fact is, we don't know whether we'll remain a capitalistic system. There's just so many things. If you start talking about over the next 95 years, how many wars will we have? How many depressions will we have? How many of all those things that could interrupt whatever program anybody sets up to invest for the future? But if we can take the steps to put the money aside, and the people who have the ability to dip into that earlier rather than later in their life, if they can be convinced that's the smart thing to do, then maybe, just maybe, this will work. Now, as I looked at this strategy recently, and the reason I looked at it is because a friend of ours, she and her husband, put in 2016, did what I suggested and had written about, and that was to put some money into this account for their grandchild. And so I don't remember if they put in more than $3,000, but let's just say they put away that $3,000, and now there were 4 years on the books. We know how that child is coming along. And one of the fascinating parts about a long-term strategy, particularly when it starts with a small amount of money, it is very difficult to really get a sense of whether you're on track or not. Because in your mind, there are two numbers you're thinking about. $3,000, that's what we started with, and the other number is $50 million, which is what they're hoping to end up with. But in between, there are going to be thousands and thousands of other numbers that they might look at. They might look at the market daily or monthly or quarterly or annually. Maybe some people will look every 5 years. But now we have almost 4 years worth of data to see how it's coming and to see how different things could be if we just did something else. Because one thing I can almost guarantee, I'll even go so far as to say I can guarantee, is that whatever you do with the money, there's going to be something that would have done better. And when we think about the lessons that we need to learn about this strategy that are likely to help us stay the course, I think one of the most important lessons is just not to focus too much on the short-term basis, but to look at what your long-term goal is and what the long-term assumptions are. We are assuming that small cap value is going to be better than money in bonds, than money in large cap value, than money in the S&P 500. And of course, who knows, maybe bonds will be the winner over the next 95 years. Hard to believe, but could be. But let's focus just on the last 4 years and see what kind of lessons there might be. I know there are at least 10 good lessons in here, but just let me go through these numbers with you and see if there are some big lessons. Now, I have said that one of the things that we know about the past is that the difference in yearly returns between the small cap value and the S&P 500 on average was about 15%. Which theoretically means if the S&P 500 makes 10%, that it would not be abnormal for the small cap value to make, 25, 10 plus 15, or minus 5, lose 5%, 10 minus 15. That would be average. Well, as we look at the last 4 years and we look at the S&P 500 and small cap value in the first year, 2016, up 24.8. By the way, this is important. That's the Vanguard small cap value. Their average size company is about $3 billion. Other small cap value funds or ETFs are at either $2 billion or less. And what do we believe? We believe that smaller companies that are small cap value are likely to do better than larger companies. So I would like to know, just for as a learning lesson here for me and for you maybe, okay, the Vanguard small cap value in 2016 made 24.8 at about an average company size of $3 billion. What about DFA, Dimensional Funds? Theirs, the average size company, is under $2 billion. Smaller companies, and by the way, more deeply discounted. How did the DFA investment do? Up 28.3%. There's no magic there. It isn't because DFA is special. They're different. And so the small cap value fund that I have in my portfolio, which is the DFA small cap value, did better than Vanguard. But what about how did they both do compared to the S&P 500? Well, the S&P 500 was up 11.8%. So the difference between the 11.8 with the S&P 500 and the 28.3 with DFA, well, there you go. There's 15% or more right there. And by the way, there's another interesting lesson to be learned here. How did the total market index do compared to the S&P 500? Well, it turned out that it compounded at 12.7, so it made almost 1% more than the S&P 500. And of course, total market index people love that because of the whole idea of the total market index is to do a little better than the S&P 500. So one, there are all sorts of lessons there in 1 year, but nothing that is shocking. But then 2017 comes along, and the small cap value is the same return as the S&P 500 the previous year. Small cap value makes 11.8. Small cap value didn't do very well that year. They only made 11.8, while the S&P 500 made 21.7%, while the total market index made 21.2. Now, why did the S&P 500 do better than the total market index? Because the average size was larger in the S&P 500, and larger and more growth-oriented did better than smaller and small value. Okay? Again, no magic. But then, the DFA small cap value in 2017 only made 7.2. Why? Because the companies are smaller and more deeply discounted. In other words, the reason that the small cap value at DFA is expected to do better than the small cap value at Vanguard over the long term is that smaller and more deeply discounted companies are likely to do better, at least they have in the past. But that doesn't mean they do better all the time. And so here are two small cap value portfolios. Two small cap value portfolios that are driven by being invested like an index. And yet one index, small cap value, makes 11.8, and another index, small cap value, means 7.2. And there'll be people who think the people who got 7.2 were not doing as good a job of picking stocks as the one that got 11.8. It's not about picking stocks. It's about how you build the portfolio to represent an asset class. One is bigger and more growth-oriented than the other. So that's 2017. And then we have hard times in 2018. The S&P 500 down 4.5, the total market index down 5.2, the small cap value at Vanguard down 12.2, and the small cap value at DFA down 15.1. You can see what happened. The larger cap companies, whether large value or large growth, did not lose as much as the smaller companies. And the smaller you got, the more you lost. And the more value-oriented you were, the more you lost. And then, in 2019, small cap value, so far this year, and we're in December, 20.3 for the year, and the S&P 500, 28.7, and the total market index, 28.2. So what has happened this year? Large has had a great year, a really good year, and small has not done as well. And the smaller you are, the worse you did. And the more value-oriented you were, the worse you did. So DFA up 16.1, small cap value up 20.3, that's at Vanguard, and the S&P 500 28.7, and total market index 28.2. Is there a reason to change your portfolio and move into the S&P 500? Well, if you just look at the bottom line, absolutely, the sooner the better. If you assume that 4 years' performance doesn't mean as much as 90 years' worth of performance, then maybe you stay the course. And by the way, there's another great lesson in here. How you invested in these particular funds had a huge difference on what your rate of return was. Let's look at two different investors. Let's look at the person who decided to put away $3,000 up front, starting in 2016. Your $3,000, if it had compounded at the 12% that you were counting on over the 95 years or 65 years until they get to retirement, the portfolio should be worth $4,721. But that's not where it is at the end of almost the end of 4 years. It's at $4,421. So the compound rate of return of what is almost a 4 year finish period is 10.2%. Not 12, 10.2. Now, what if the person instead, what if they put in $365 a year? So now the money goes in the first of each year has a different return, and all of a sudden the compound rate of return is going to depend on the series of returns. And not on the just pure compound rate of return. So let me with small cap value at Vanguard, here's the impact of dollar cost averaging over a 4 year period. Now, if you were able to get the 12% return, remember you did not get 12, you got 10.2 when you did the lump sum up front. But if you had gotten a straight 12% return with the $365 a year, at the end of 4 years, you'd have $1,744. But you didn't. You ended the 4 years with $1,792. And that is a compound rate of return of 13.9%. So the person who is putting away $365 and thinking, okay, if I could just get a 12% compound rate of return over the next 65 years, then we'd be on our way to building that $50 million lifetime payoff and the estate you left to others. Well, in fact, because of the series of returns, you ended up actually making more than 12%. Now, remember, the S&P 500 underperformed in one of the 4 years, but outperformed small cap value in the other 3 years. Okay, here's what happened now. Lump sum, $3,000 up front versus dollar cost averaging into the S&P over the 4 years. Lump sum. You remember you started with 3,000. In order to have compounded that return at 10% a year, remember that's the long-term goal, you would have ended the period with about $4,392. But what did you get? With that one $3,000 investment, you ended with $5,016. So you got a 10%, you got more than a 10% return. Turns out you got a 13.7% return over that 4 years. But if you dollar cost averaged into the portfolio instead of ending up with $1,694 for the first 4 years at $365, you actually ended up with $2,075, a 24% compound rate of return for the first 4 years. Now let's get real. Are you counting on the S&P 500 to make 24% over the next 65 years or whatever? No, of course not. So already I think we've learned some important lessons. Certainly over the short term, we can't expect everything that we want to happen, or everything that's happened in the past to happen exactly the same. But we do know that over the short term, that the S&P 500 will easily trounce small cap value, because those will be the periods that large cap and growth-oriented companies do better. And we also have learned that it is the difference between lump sum returns and dollar cost averaging can be wildly different. We also, I think, have already learned that the difference between the S&P 500 and small cap value 1 year at a time, that difference can be huge. And remember that the average difference at the end of a year is about 15%. Now, that's a big, big difference. Now, let's see. And I think also it would be fair to say that we're starting to accumulate a list of things that we would say are our expectations, and then what we would call the reality, that those differences are going to be much wider than what we probably expect. And I think we also know that the difference between the S&P 500 and the total market indexes, that those differences are going to be relatively small, and it won't be shocking to find out that the S&P 500 does better than the total market index, as it did from 1928 to 2019. I think it'll be helpful to learn some other lessons here while we're at it, because getting used to the difference between what small cap value and large cap blend, the S&P 500 and total market index, to get used to these broad differences. And so I decided it might be helpful if I looked at all of the years that these asset classes did better than 20%. As well as looking at the number of years and the average losses when they lost more than 20%. I thought these might be important things we should be prepared for. First of all, let's talk about the number of years that the S&P 500 and the small cap value made more than 20%. And it's a lot of the years. As a matter of fact, the S&P 500 made more than 20% in 34 of the last 92 years. That's almost a 36% of the periods that they made more than 20%. Small cap value made more than 20%. In 45 of the years, or almost 49% of the time. So getting big returns, more than 20%, to qualify, is not an unusual thing to happen. And this just happens to be one of those years that appears to be happening. But the average gain for the S&P 500, when it goes over 20%, the average gain is 31.6%, And in the case of the small cap value, 43%. So small cap value over 20, about 49% of the time, and the average return when it's over 20 has been over 43%. And in the case of the S&P 500, about 35%, 36% of the time it's over 20, and the average gain is 31.6%. Now that's when things are good. And that's, by the way, that's a big advantage, over 10% more per year with a small cap value when they have a gain of 20%. So that's the good times. But it's not going to shock you to learn that in the bad times, the losses are higher than the losses with the S&P 500. So with the S&P 500, there were 6 years that they lost more than 20%. And that was about 6.5% of the time. In the case of small cap value, there were 8 years out of 92 that they lost more than 20%, and that's about 8.7% of the time. So the small cap value investors had to accept more years with losses of more than 20%. But what about the averages? Well, it turns out the average loss with the S&P 500, remember, that was in 6 out of 92 years, was 29.8%. The average loss with small cap value, 38.4%. So small cap value had two more big losses, and the average loss was almost 10% more. So I think this is important to bring up because I have made the case that over the long run, that small cap value appears to be less risky than the S&P 500. And the reason I came to that conclusion was when I looked at the worst 40 years with the small cap value, the returns were substantially better than the worst 4 years with the S&P 500. But that was over a long period of time. And I can't stop there because there's another lesson in here maybe it'll be a surprise, and that is that it may appear like this strategy to build $3,000 into $50 million. You mean it may feel like it's just an outlandish return over time, but remember, over time is a big part of this. If we follow the $3,000 and do get a 12% return, then by the time that it's retirement at 65, if that's the magic date, the $3,000 would have grown to over $4.7 million. At 10%, it's about almost $1.5 million. At 8%, and I mention 8% because that is the likely return of a balanced target date fund over that lifetime would be about $446,000. And so that's the huge difference from $446,000 to $4.8 million. From 8 to 12%. But then look at the implications of living off that money at 65. 5% of the 4.745 million is about 238,000. 5% of the almost a million five is about 73,000. And 5% of the 446,000 is about 22,000. So that's a huge difference. But now Let's inflation adjust over that period of time. Over a 65-year period, a 3% inflation rate would mean that if that $4.7 million produced a 5% payout of $238,000, that would be the equivalent, inflation adjusted, of about $33,000. So it's not like you created a miracle. You have created you've taken an investment and it's built to be worth a substantial amount of money. But if in essence in today's spending power it turns out to be $33,000, not $238,000, then that's a nice gift to leave. But again, not as big as it might have seemed without that inflation adjustment. In the case of having grown it at 10% to about $1.5 million or so, instead of having a $73,000 plus payout, it's a $10,000 payout on an inflation-adjusted basis. And if you got the 8% and had some $446,000 in the pool, and that 5% would have equaled about $22,000, inflation adjusted back to today would be about $3,000. So what you would have achieved by investing $3,000 and letting it grow at 8% would have paid out in today's dollars about the amount of money you put in. Now, that's not a bad investment, but we have to take inflation into consideration. So all of these lessons, in my mind, are meant to create a wall of expectations around that investment that would guard it from somebody doing something that is emotionally driven because it feels so uncomfortable for the short term. So what do we know? That small cap value will underperform other asset classes often, and that there will be periods of large declines, could be larger declines than those asset classes that have lower rates of return. That's the nature of investing. I think we also need to see that this is not a miracle to go from $3,000 to $50 million. It just assumes a certain rate of return that is relatively normal in the market, whether it's normal for the S&P 500 at 10% or small cap value at 12%. It also, by the way, I think is much easier today to have happen than it would have been even 10 years ago, because the internal costs of running these index funds have declined so far that more money, in fact, almost all the money you make, is left in the pocket of the investor instead of being a reward for Wall Street. And I do think it's helpful to understand that year by year, even decade by decade, the differences can be substantial. We're about to work on an article for January. I think that the title is going to be 9 Lessons from 9 Decades. And you're going to see the decades, the return for different asset classes for 9 decades, the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, etc. I don't share all these numbers just because I think it makes me feel smart. I'm not smart. These are not my numbers. These are the numbers that other people, very smart people, have taken the time to dig out from history. But I think they're more dependable, particularly if we're honest enough to have our eye not just on the good times, but also on the bad times, because that's what we and our heirs are going to have to live through in order to get these very fine returns for the long term. And I think that those of us who are trying to help other people, I'm talking about those of us who put money aside for children and grandchildren with the idea that it will have the power of compounding to impact it and could make a big difference in the future for these young people. We have the right attitude, and our challenge, particularly my challenge, is at age 76. By the way, I think last week I said I was 77. My wife reminds me, I'm 76. But the bottom line is that, how long am I going to be around to tell this story? How long are you going to be around to tell this story? And the challenge is, what do we do about getting this story into the hands of the people who are going to need to have the discipline to let the time work and the equity asset classes, the risk exposure, let it play out over time. Now, we are working right now. Rich Buck and I are working on a book that is focused on the $12 million investment decisions. We hope that that'll be around and continue to work for us. But you know how books are. Books come out and they're popular for a year. If it's 2 or 3 years, you're lucky. And so it is going to be an ongoing challenge to keep this story, this idea, this strategy, and all the numbers behind it in front of those that we love, that we're doing this for, so that hopefully they'll have the discipline to let it go. So over the next few years, I do want to focus on producing some information, and it certainly can't be this podcast because it's way too complex for the young people that we're trying to help. But in the coming years, we will produce information that we hope will help keep the discipline to be, one, a buy and holder, and two, to have it in equities so that you have the legitimate chance for the long-term growth. I hope that helps. And if you have some ideas on how this story can be told and how we can leave this legacy of information to our loved ones, please let me know, because in the long run, that's going to be the magic of this having the impact that we hope that it will have. Thanks for listening. And by the way, thank you, all of you who were kind enough to send us a contribution. It is all helpful. Many of the contributions were 25, and some were 100, and a few were even higher. It all helps, and I promise we will look for all the ways that we can to get this information in the hands of all those young people who have so many, many important decisions to make for their financial future. Thanks for listening.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.